What's your Thanksgiving song?
The cranberry sauce. We're having mashed potatoes. Ooh, the turkey looks great.
Len.
Thank you for loving me.
Len.
Thank you for being there.
Oh, God.
Everyone's thanking.
Len.
The whole world's thanking you.
Stop.
Thanking
Len.
Us for thanking
Stop.
You.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Cranberry sauce. We're having mashed potatoes. Ooh, the turkey looks great. Thank you for loving me.
Len.
Thank you for being there.
Please.
Thank you for loving me. Everyone's thanking. The whole
Len.
World's thanking you. Thanking
Stop.
Us for thanking you.
The next one comes from Alex One, who starts out by saying yes. So he's very excited about the show. He says, question for Bruce. I've been reading many criticisms regarding Zechariah Sitchin's translations of various ancient texts. Having traveled to Egypt with him, would you consider this a valid criticism? Or, in your view, are his translations acceptable? We kind of went over this a little bit, but I feel like
he's traveled. I've seen evidence that at least some of his translations are acceptable to museum curators. He told me, and I believe him, that he had had many private conversations with a number of museum curators, and he would not name names, nor did I ask him. But he made a point of saying he didn't want to name names. But I still believe him, that there were several museum curators who believed that his theories were correct, but they couldn't do anything about it. Their answer to him was, what would you have us do? Have everyone that got an Egyptology degree go through it all over again? And now the answer pretty much is yes. Eventually they're going to have to.
Anyway. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it depends. Do you want to learn something, or do you just want to keep repeating mistakes and being idiots? So it really came down to questions of economy and the ability of people to understand. It would take a long time to take a bunch of, you know, hide-bound people who'd gone through the old school and re-educate them
right.
to any of this. And in a sense, that's kind of what Sitchin was doing. He's talking to people like me who are listening to him and paying attention and saying, you know what, I think you're right here.
He was sort of doing a grassroots Egyptology flip, if you will.
Yes. And a very effective one, too.
It seems that way. I mean, they got a program called Ancient Aliens, for Christ's sake.
That's right.
So.
That's right. It's becoming more and more commonly known. I mean, obviously not everyone accepts it. But the point is, ancient astronauts have been discussed, at least in this country, since early 1970s. And in Russia, they were being discussed a great deal earlier than that. So it's not a new theory. But back then, it was just a few people on the fringe, and I was one of them, who were studying those things. Now, it's kind of common knowledge. Whether, how many people accept it or believe it, that's a whole different question. But the idea of it? No, everyone's aware of the idea of it.
Okay.
And of some of the history or reasons why it looks like a valid theory.
All right. So you stand by Sitchin's translations of, you know, obviously you can't swear by them or anything like that, but you hold it in high regard,
yes.
I guess we'll say.
I consider his translations to be no more invalid than any other expert's. I don't think he was slanting too much. I do have to say, Sitchin did make some errors, I believe, and he was known to slant his case a little bit. He didn't necessarily always present evidence quite fairly, but I believe that he was basically true to the arguments. He didn't actually make anything up, and I believe his translations are pretty valid.
Okay. Red Sun Superman asks, would you consider using Twitter in the future to share your opinions on various films, books, shows on a routine basis, albeit in short 140-character bursts? I notice you have provided lengthy reviews on Amazon.com for various movies and books, so you like providing your opinion. Twitter might be a better way to connect with those who have read your books and find your opinion valuable.
I would be more inclined to create a blog, actually.
Yeah, it seems like, having read Bruce's emails, 140 characters is laughable.
No. Yes.
And that's not a shot at, that's a shot at Twitter, not Red Sun Superman. It's
I don't do
not
short.
Possible. Yeah.
Although, ironically, at fiction writing, I'm better at short stories than anything else. But, I don't really do short. If I were going to do something, I'd do a blog. And, in fact, I've had friends suggest that to me. I'm just such a babe in the woods when it comes to that stuff. I've never done any of this.
I'm telling you, just send your stuff to me. I'll post it up in all of America. It'll take all that shit out of the way. Just send me what you want to post. I don't care.
I may do that.
People want to read your stuff.
That, and if I know friends that could set me up on a blog real easy. It's not hard, I know. I've never done it.
Yeah.
If someone got me set up on a blog, I'd probably be blogging quite a bit.
All right. Well, that's something for me to work on then over the holidays, because I've been trying to get the BOA set up into a blog format. We could bring you in.
Just in case anyone's curious, since they found the Amazon reviews, I haven't done any of those in 10 years. The reason for that was I used to automatically connect from the computer to the site. Somehow or other, must have been when the software was reloaded or something, it lost the password, and I'd never could find the password.
Oh,
I don't remember what it was. I thought I had it. And they were changing our email address literally every week back then. So it could have been any one of 20 different email addresses, and I don't even remember what they all were. In any event, I couldn't reconnect to it, so that's why there weren't any more of them.
Okay. Now, I did ask that these be serious questions, but Red Sun Superman asked sort of a goofy question, but actually that led me into looking into the origins of the goofy question, and now I want to know more, so we're going to include this one. It's kind of a silly question, but he asks, do you think Fred and Daphne from Scooby-Doo had sex? He mentions your Shag and Scoob come of age review on Amazon, which I was like, what is this guy talking about? So then I dug into it and found the review, and in the review you mentioned this movie. I don't have the name in front of me. I think it's Versus Aliens or something. It's kind of ironically something right along right in your wheelhouse, and you allude to that they allude to Fred and Daphne having sex at the beginning of the movie that only adults would understand. So what's the story behind that?
I'm trying to remember exactly which one that was. Those movies are a lot of fun. I should preface this by saying I'm a Scooby-Doo freak. I just love Scooby-Doo. There are very, very few incarnations of Scooby-Doo that I don't love. I do have a thing for family entertainment, if you want to call it that. It's kind of rare anymore. You don't see too much of it. Scooby-Doo is probably top of that list.
It's Scooby-Doo and the Alien Invaders. That's the
Scooby-Doo and the Alien Invaders. Yes. Did they have sex? Yes. Yes, they did. I believe they were deliberately alluding to that. They make lesbian jokes on Velma. They do a lot of adult stuff in those movies that kids would never catch. They would never catch any of that. But yes, they are putting those things in those movies that directly relate to adult sexual humor.
Interesting. Yeah, it's from the year 2000, so it sounds like it's sort of the postmodern Scooby-Doo in a way.
Oh, yeah. Scooby-Doo has improved so much over the years. It had to. Otherwise, it could only become a parody of itself. And there are different versions of Scooby-Doo, certainly. Some of them are more juvenile. Those are usually not as good. But the ones that kind of catch on or are fun are the ones that appeal to adults every bit as much as they do kids.
Yeah. I'll have to look that one up for sure. I want to see these allusions.
Well, practically all of them from that whole era. I forget how many movies they made. I've got most of them. You can pick them up for cheap. But, yeah, I'm just a Scooby-Doo nut. I love Scooby-Doo.
The next question comes from Robert C., who wants to know about your views on the fact that Hollywood is using subtle hints to acclimate the herd, not only in terms of ETs as discussed on BOA Audio in Season 4, but also many other subtle hints, particularly in the movie The Matrix, showing that dude's ID card with date of birth 9/11/2001. He has seen other examples, as he's sure you have too, and he thinks that would lend more credibility to your ET angle. So...
Wow, that's interesting. I was unaware of the 9/11. I don't even doubt it. Especially considering it predated 9/11, that does make it interesting.
Yeah, there's quite a few of those little 9/11 hints in the mainstream media before 9/11.
I'm one of those people that believes that we let it happen, absolutely. We either let it happen or made it happen. Take your pick.
Now, do you think the subtle hints leading up to it were from the government? This is what this guy's suggesting. I feel like maybe it's more just like people picking up something in the ether and putting it in by accident. But what do you
possible?
Think?
That's really hard to say. I'm with you on that. I don't know. Sometimes I think things are just kind of in the ether. In this particular case, there's a lot of really squirrely stuff the government gets itself involved in. Right before 9/11, literally the day before, the government released an article on Operation Northwood. Some of you may remember this. You could look it up on the web, and it would confirm all this for you.
Yeah.
Operation Northwood was Kennedy era, about the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when they were proposing that the CIA create a terrorist event in order to justify military attacks on Cuba, and by extension, any other country that you wanted it to be. So right before 9/11, I think it was right on September 10th, pow, they happen to release this. There's a newspaper article on it, hits the news, and the very next day, pow, 9/11. Okay. However you want to read this, people. However you want to read this. You can either believe that a bunch of guys with box cutters in caves in Afghanistan just happened to know the very day that we were going to be running Pentagon exercises that Dick Cheney would be in charge of running airplanes into buildings, because that's what was taking place on 9/11. So you can either believe that they just happened to know that and managed to squeeze by all the security and get this done, and that after the first plane hit, we waited. How long was it before the second plane hit? And that during that entire time, nobody contacted Dick Cheney and said, is this part of the drill? And that after one hit, we didn't do something to stop any further things from happening? You can believe that if you want. I've got some pyramids I'd like to sell you. Really, just $1 billion down.
And I guess to follow up in a way on Robert's question, he's hinting that the government is using these subtle hints. Well, I guess he's not hinting it. He's suggesting that the government's using these subtle hints to, I guess the key word here that stood out to me in his question is acclimate the herd. Do you think this is sort of the old revelation of method concept that
yes,
part of
they
the grand
love doing
conspiracy,
that.
Yeah, is to reveal
the government
what
loves revealing itself in cryptic fashion and laughing at you while they're doing it. Yeah, they love that. They love having clever little acronyms. You remember how when we first were invading Iraq, I forget what the name of the operation was. Operation Iraqi Liberation, that was it.
Yeah.
Oil. They changed that to Operation Iraqi Freedom because oil was just a little too obvious.
Yeah, they went oif.
Yep. But originally it was Operation Iraqi Liberation.
I never even thought of that. I never even put that all together. Yeah, weird.
They love that shit.
All right, the next question comes from David K., who says, I would like a question or two about the first V series and the second, and as such, he'd like to know your thoughts on the recent update, as well as what you thought of the original, which he thought was wonderfully subversive for the time.
Interesting. He's just asking what I think about the difference between the two?
I guess, yeah. He wants to know your thoughts on the original, your thoughts on the recent update. So that's the two questions, I guess.
Well, the original, I think that was actually a very deliberate part of, on the part of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was interested in trying to acclimate people to this subject. He'd had UFO sightings himself that he was very excited about when he was governor. In fact, one interviewer knew about that and asked him about it and said that Reagan got really animated when he asked him that. Said, oh, yeah, and he was telling him all about it. Then he realized he was talking to a journalist, and suddenly he clammed up on it and didn't say another word. So I think that Reagan was very interested in publicizing UFO awareness and actually did quite a bit of work toward that end. V would definitely have been part of that. I'm assuming that he wanted to demonize the subject because usually Republicans love to demonize the subject. It makes for better military spending, and that's their single pork barrel project. They like to go after the Democrats for all the pork. Oh, yeah, that's true. The Democrats have got a shit ton of pork barrel projects. The Republicans have one. It's called the military. They like to sink every bit of money that they possibly can into it. So anyway, that was probably part of the subliminal exercise in trying to scare everyone into believing that these human-looking aliens are really evil reptiles that want to consume the entire human race and do horrible things to us. You're going to get more defense funding that way.
Yeah.
But the primary thing I think that series accomplished was the special effects of just having the flying saucers parked over all the major cities of the Earth like it's nothing, and the way that that would change people's awareness. Because you know they have to have had this conversation in intelligence circles and with the Joint Chiefs. You know, what happens when we publicize this? If we don't, this is going to happen someday, and how do we deal with that then, and what is the reaction going to be?
Right.
And I do think that's what's going to happen, frankly. I don't think the government's ever going to publicize it until such time as they park over our cities or make themselves incredibly obvious. And at that point, they're just going to be running to the microphones as fast as they can, saying, we knew all along, guys. We knew all along. We were just trying to protect you.
So that's the original. What did you think of the updated version that was out a couple of years ago?
I saw, how many episodes of that did I see? I might have seen as many as 5 of those.
I think I dropped out right when you did.
Yeah. I didn't drop out of it because I didn't like it. I thought it was fine. I've never much cared for V. I need to preface this.
Okay.
V is just military propaganda bullshit. It's a war story, you know, updated to include aliens and scare everyone as far as aliens are concerned.
Right. I heard it was like an allegory for the Nazis and shit. So.
Yeah, they kind of like to paint it up that way.
Because they can't say it's an allegory for aliens. So this
right. I just never was that impressed with it. It was too simplistic for me, too comic book. Most of the stuff in the Reagan era was. The update had very nice, predictably, it had great special effects. I thought it had a very good cast. The scripts were better than I expected. I wasn't having a bad time with it. I kind of enjoyed it. It was on at an awkward time. I was usually catching it after the fact on something like Hulu at work when I had time to kill. But that was right about the time that that site went down, and I ended up moving to the other site that went down last year. This is what happens in security. You get moved from site to site because you just lose the contract.
Yeah.
It just goes down. Anyway, my car was dying. The site went down. I got moved over, and I just sort of forgot about it. I never got back into it. The next thing I knew, it wasn't on anymore. I had predicted it wouldn't be on anymore, even if it was any good. I predicted it wouldn't be on anymore. I don't think it was bad. It's just that there's not much you can do with V. It's pretty simplistic.
Right, right. It turns into a basic sort of us versus them.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's an us versus them army man story, just with a little bit more sci-fi stuff, and these guys happen to be from another planet. Battle of Los Angeles, you know.
Yeah. I tried to follow it, but I gave up on it. I didn't have any sort of disruption. And you know, in my habitualness, I was just like, enough's enough. I can't follow this show anymore. I think I watched the first season, which I think was truncated to like 7 or 8 episodes, and then when the second season started, I was like, do I want to get on board with V?
Do I want to get sucked into this?
Yeah, and then I was like, you know, I think I can let V go, because I don't think it's, because its ratings, it barely survived to make a second season, and a show like that, unless it starts out coming out of the gate like with a big bang, like Lost, and then slowly, you know, the audience, it slowly loses an audience, but still by the end it's got a decent audience. This show started out of the gate like weak as hell, and then with a serialized show, you're always losing viewers, it seems.
You know what started out every bit as weak or weaker was The X-Files. The first 6 months, it had no ratings at all. It's amazing that Fox renewed it and kept it going past the 13 episodes. That's one of the things I argue for government influence, because its ratings did not support it.
Well, I guess you might wonder then about Fringe, because that's kind of the same story. So,
sure.
I don't know if you follow that. I haven't got into that. I'm going to wait till the whole series is over. I'm going to do the exact same thing.
Yeah. I have friends that have tried to get me to watch it for quite a while. I caught 2 or 3 episodes along the way. Again, not bad. I've just got other things to do.
Yeah, and ever since Lost, I just can't get on board with these serialized shows.
Yeah, Abrams kind of tripped over his thing there.
Right, right. So I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. If I watch all of Fringe when it's finally done, and I'm like, that was a very satisfying story, pretty much from beginning to end, and it wrapped up nicely and tightly, then you know I'll patronize the makers and in subsequent things. So
sure.
The makers of Lost, no, I won't follow their shit now.
Well, it was just, in what, 7 years? I mean, the thing went on and on and on and on and on, and they get you sucked in and dragged along, and then just,
yeah.
Come on, guys. I could have made up something. You didn't have anything from the last 3 weeks. You could have made something up in the last 3 weeks that would have tied everything together.
Not
you
exactly.
You could have done it.
Yeah, so frustrating. And as far as the second V goes, part of the other thing that turned me off was you remember it was like Juliet from Lost. She was like the FBI agent who was sort of leading the underground and also had one foot in the government camp. But it was like she was a New York FBI agent. And in the 8 episodes I saw in the first season, it never like got into what the White House or the federal government was doing about all this, seemed to me completely unbelievable. So,
well, that was kind of a flaw with the original V, too, I think. Really, it was just too simplistic. It didn't get into realistic questions. It evaded realistic questions in favor of, you know, just let's have some boots on the ground shooting going on.
Right. All right. Next question comes from Susan F. She wants to know what you think of the recent flourish of films and TV series about the paranormal and ghost hunting, and ponders if it is being used to mold our thoughts on the matter. So we kind of touched on that a little bit as far as the revelation of method, but this is a different, so this is an acclimation, I guess, molding. That's an interesting word to use. So you think they're sort of shaping people's thoughts on the paranormal via this stuff, or is it just cheap and easy to produce, and you know, it's, as my friend Greg Bishop likes to call it, UFO porn?
6 of one, half a dozen of the other. I think it's mostly UFO porn. Mostly. I could be wrong. I was commenting earlier on, you know, ghost hunters shows. They're just crap. This is just bullshit.
Yeah, paranormal.
Turn on a green camera. Did you see that? Did you see that? What was that? That's you being overdramatic about absolutely nothing. That's what that is. And it costs nothing to produce these shows. Just zip. So I think that's the primary appeal right there. Theater started to go to crap all the way back in the 1970s, about the time that Pippin was produced. And then along came A Chorus Line, and everything went straight to shit, because everyone was just looking for a super way to put up super cheap shows that you would get a huge return on. Well, what do you do? Let's have no set and a bunch of people in leotards who just stand forth and sing their individual numbers. And then you have cats and all this other kind of crap. That's where it all started to fall to shit. And TV was just a little late jumping into that bandwagon and that party. But yeah, they've discovered the cheap and easy way too, with reality TV shows and bullshit paranormal shows. And they are just bullshit. I can't remember the last time I saw anything on a paranormal show that I had the remotest belief in at all. I was kind of interested to find out that one of the UFO shows, or I think it was just one of the paranormal shows, did do a 90-minute segment on Travis Walton. That was actually kind of interesting, because Walton hadn't been up in front of the cameras and told his story for a very long time. And it may be the first time he's ever gotten up and been able to tell it at any kind of length. I was picking up a few details that I hadn't gotten from his written accounts. They didn't conflict with anything he'd said before, but it was just interesting to hear him say it.
Yeah. All right. So do you think beyond, I guess, are you dismissing sort of an agenda to mold in a way? Do you think there's anything like that going on? I don't see why. I guess you have to wonder why the government would want to mold people's thoughts on. I can see UFOs, ghosts, and Bigfoot. Why would they care about what people think of that stuff?
They don't, but they have a vested interest, and this very much fits into my book. They have a vested interest in trying to create a media circus atmosphere.
Okay.
The Amityville Horror was on again just the other night, the original. The Amityville Horror was a straw dog if ever there was one. It's just a BS story from start to finish, and I never did buy it. It was just bullshit. I don't remember what page I got to. I think by page 30 I was laughing too hard to continue reading it. And I had friends that were going, oh my God, this is the scariest thing I've ever read. No, it's not. This is bullshit. Turn on your bullshit detector. And, you know, years later, lo and behold, some research was done on it. I read an excellent book. I can't remember the author's name now. But he'd spent a long time debunking that particular story. It was cooked up between Ron DeFeo Jr., who murdered his family, and his lawyer to make some money and to try and come up with a plea, you know. And then, you know, it's become an industry since. Well, that was produced, the original movie was produced by American International Pictures. And American International Pictures is as closely tied to the intelligence community as you could get. They were producing all of Roger Corman's stuff, and I go into detail on all that in my book. But interestingly, they seem to have a vested interest in trying to sell the Amityville Horror. And that's just its own separate story. It takes a bit of research. And that one guy's book, I'd have to go downstairs to find it. I've got it. I could pick it up and give you his name. He did an independently published book just talking about that subject, and I thought he did an excellent job of covering it.
Okay.
Now I don't even remember what the original question was. I got sidetracked.
Just, I guess, about the government molding people's thoughts on
yes.
The unknown, if you will.
Where the government has a vested interest in that is that they want to lump things like UFOs into Bigfoot, Elvis being alive, anything tinfoil hat.
Yes, smear,
so
if you will.
So they want to make these subjects as ridiculous as they possibly can in order that they will have something else they can lump into it, and UFOs being one of them. It was on one of those shows that I saw the Travis Walton thing. That's just for a single example, which doesn't mean that they did a bad job of covering Travis Walton, but they put it on a show that people are not really going to take very credibly.
Right, right, right. I remember they had an ABC special like that a couple years ago. It was like 2 hours long, and the first half was really good, and then it got all crazy and shit about ET hybrids and stuff. And whether or not you believe in that part, it's like, let's just keep things separated if we're going to present to the mainstream.
Right.
All right. Next question comes from Brent H., and he is down in Australia. He asks, actually, he wants to know if you thought Prometheus was crap. And he says 90%... He says 90% of the people he knows down here in Oz thought so for many and varied reasons. So what are your thoughts on Prometheus?
I'm actually glad that that particular movie came up. Prometheus is one of the most overhyped movies I've seen. I love Ridley Scott. I was just puzzled when I was done with that movie, and every review site that I've gone to has asked the exact same questions that were in my mind when that movie was over. I wouldn't necessarily say it was crap. It was... Let's be specific. It was gorgeously produced crap. It was a splendid roller coaster ride. It had some great stuff in it. It was a lot of fun. But it really did not answer a single question. It did not have a plot that made any sense. It just threw a whole lot of shit at you. And even the people I know that love that movie say that. They just liked the whole lot of shit that was thrown at them and liked the fact that it wasn't answered. I prefer to have some story that actually makes some concrete sense. What this was, I think, was a teaser for a new Alien movie series. And as a teaser, yeah, it's great. But it really doesn't answer anything. And as a movie, it does fall far short in a number of categories. Gorgeously produced, though. Great cast, gorgeous production. It's impressive. But, yeah, it's severely flawed.
Now, what about
also, this is something I have to bring up. If anyone ever saw the movie Leviathan, I mean, back in 1989, it was an MGM movie, MGM United Artists. And it was the exact same story as Prometheus. That was kind of an Alien ripoff, and I thought it was really peculiar. The entire time I was watching it, all I could think of was Leviathan, and I said, Ridley, seriously? You've had, what, 30-some years to come up with a prequel to this, and what you chose for a prequel to this was a ripoff of your original movie? Because it was the exact same plot. It was just set undersea. You had a bunch of oil workers undersea who come across this sunken Russian ship that had some bioweapon on it that was turning people into bioweapons. And it's the same damn story.
All right. So what about as far as, now I think he was asking for like sort of a straight up review, but I'm sure other people are wondering because, you know, the paranormal community reads a lot into these films and stuff. Did you see anything in there that resonated with your milieu, if you will?
Yes, quite a bit. Just from the very start, they had one a completely unnecessary scene where they show people studying the cave drawings and saying, we came from the stars. They could have cut 5 minutes out of the movie that would have helped so much. It just tripped up the pace right from the start. They really should have clipped that scene because they recount all of that when they wake up on their mission and all that type of thing.
Yeah.
You didn't need to show that. It just made it that 5 minutes too long and got it off on the wrong tone. Really would have made it would have made it a completely different movie if they had. But they're immediately throwing the ancient astronaut thing in your face. It does resonate exactly with what I'm writing about. The idea is that the human race originated someplace else. And he's even hinting at the idea that these guys were the gods, and the gods did try to destroy us at one point, you know, face it, or more than one point in mythology.
Yeah.
In fact, they succeeded at least once, probably more than that. So, yeah, it's setting up the exact same historical milieu of what I'm talking about. As to how successful it was, like I said, as a teaser, it's great. It's a great setup for whatever the next movie will be. But as its own movie, yeah, it's severely flawed. I thought that was just a very, very odd choice for him to make.
So maybe you'll look back on it when all, kind of like Fringe, when all the stuff's all out, finally you'll maybe look back and think, oh, actually, now that all makes sense.
Yeah,
he'll
probably answer all the questions later. I had the same problem with 2001. Everyone that tells me 2001 is such an incredibly great movie. No, it's not. It's a piece of shit. It's a gorgeous piece of film, and it's got one concrete story in it, and even it doesn't end satisfactorily. That's the Hal story, the mad computer. Other than that, it's just a bunch of weird stuff that's tossed out at you with no resolution anywhere. It doesn't have any concrete story. So as a movie, it stinks. As a piece of film, it's incredible.
All right. Next question comes from Steve G. He wants to know if you think that the zombie/apocalypse genre movies and shows are a metaphor for future societal collapse.
Oh, wow, that one's fun.
So what do you think of that? There's this big zombie apocalyptic boom, and you wonder...
Oh, I make zombie apocalypse jokes all the time. In fact, Joss Whedon just made a very funny one where he was talking about... he was for Obama, of course, so he was talking about Romney and making him Zomney. Zomney and the zombie apocalypse. Vote for the zombie apocalypse. A vote for Romney is a vote for the zombie apocalypse. And he's very low-key about it. He's doing it all from his kitchen and making just this big Shaggy Dog joke out of it. But it got a good laugh out of me. Yeah, I joke about the zombie apocalypse all the time. The mere fact that the words zombie apocalypse have become a meme. They are in the public consciousness. You can say it anywhere, and anyone knows what you're talking about. They're automatically on the same page with you. The mere fact that it has reached that proportion tells you something. I don't even know what it is it tells you. I always thought from the time that George A. Romero was making his first movies that he was just doing a metaphor for the great unwashed, you know, and suburbanites, and or people stuck in urban blight that are just moving through their life by sleepwalk motions. I think that's what he was trying to do originally, and certainly it carries through now, especially when, you know, you have legions of unemployed popping up. I'm one of them. I never pictured I was going to be unemployed again, you know. You just don't. It happens. Say, poof, surprise, there you are. You're a zombie now. You got hit by the virus. Oops. So, yeah, I do think that there are some kind of interesting things you can read into it. I've always thought that it was a metaphor for the great unwashed, so to speak, especially since more and more of us find ourselves ending up as the great unwashed, whether we are or not.
Yeah.
We find ourselves stuck in that, you know, the common throng and in reduced circumstances and such. I think that's what that's a metaphor for.
Interesting, yeah. So, in a way, he says future societal collapse, but you almost wonder if it's just ongoing societal collapse.
Ongoing, so that's the answer right there. I think it's ongoing societal collapse. And just by the by, I think that the government's been very worried about this for a very, very long period of time. We've been in gradual stages of collapse for a long time. I frequently take shots at Ronald Reagan because I think he was a terrible president. The policies he established created all the problems we're in now. However, the reason he was able to get away with creating the policies that he created was because we were kind of on the verge of collapse then. And we've been doing nothing except artificially propping ourselves up repeatedly in different ways, not necessarily the right ways, and I think definitely the wrong ways, and history will bear that out. Huh. But the point is that we get by making all kinds of mistakes. 9/11 was a big mistake, and yeah, I do think we were responsible for that. We decided we wanted to do the Imperial Oil Wars thing. Well, guess what? Bad call. I don't think that's going to work out. It hasn't been, and here's our economy collapsing still.
Yeah.
They keep coming up with Band-Aids to put on the collapsing economy. So ongoing, yeah, I think that's the best word for it.
Okay. Next question comes from One to Believe, and he or she would like to ask you what your impressions are of some of the TV and movie productions that have been produced since you concluded the awesome Rux trilogy a few years ago, which inspired him to track down a copy of your excellent book, Hollywood vs. the Aliens. So, see, we sold at least one book, but you don't even see anything from that because it's probably on eBay or something.
Yeah, it's been out of print for a little while now. Apparently. I just found that out a few months ago.
Yeah. I could have sworn someone asked about that, but I don't see it here, so I'll do a quick check after we're done with these questions. And he says a few examples he can think of are, and there's a ton of them, so just I guess we'll just pick a couple that you might be interested or have resonated with you. He says Apollo 18, Cowboys and Aliens, Super 8, Battle of L.A., Skyline, Paul, Men in Black 3, Prometheus, which we talked about, plus reworks of Total Recall and Planet of the Apes, as well as TV series like The Event, Falling Skies, Fringe, Flash Forward, and UK shows like Life on Mars, Torchwood, and new episodes of Red Dwarf. And he's not sure if you've seen any of these yet, but he'd love to hear your views on the last few years of sci-fi TV and movies.
Three or four of those I haven't seen.
Like, so the vast minority you have not seen.
The vast minority I have not seen. The rest of them, most of them are pretty disappointing overall. For Apollo 18, that was a great idea. It kind of got killed by shaky cam. Really, it was a sort of a reworking of an Outer Limits episode that was a much better Outer Limits episode with the talking rocks, if you ever saw that one. That was a really, really scary episode. They kind of transplanted that one to the moon, and it almost worked. They were almost there. I enjoy that movie more than most people do. It bombed terribly, but I'm sure it still made money hand over fist because it cost nothing to produce. In fact, I'm surprised that there's not a sequel to it already, even if it was a bomb, because it would make money, too. It wasn't bad. It's kind of a good scary movie. It just got killed by shaky cam. throw some of the other names at me.
Let me see. Cowboys and Aliens?
Cowboys and Aliens was done much better as High Plains Invaders by Sci-Fi Channel. It's the same movie.
Yeah, I heard that at the time. Yeah,
Liked it better on Sci-Fi. I thought High Plains Invaders was, I don't know, because it was smaller and simpler, and it just had more heart, kind of. Cowboys and Aliens was too overblown for me.
All right, fair enough.
Okay. It was all right.
We'll try another. We'll do some TV shows here. Well, we talked about a little bit about Fringe. We can cross that one out. How about The Event? Did you follow The Event? A lot of people in the paranormal field were all a tither about that.
I tried to follow The Event. I started watching the event, and I lost track of it. It was either on at a time that I couldn't see it, or I think I tuned into it a couple times, and it wasn't there. They moved it or something. It was like it wasn't always on when it was supposed to be. In any event, I couldn't keep up with it. I was enjoying what I saw of it. I thought it was fascinating. I definitely wanted to see more. It had that same kind of hook quality to it that Lost did, and I was very much afraid that it was going to end up the same way. But I had to admit, the hook really had me all the way from the start. Is that on disc? I'd love to see it.
I'm not sure, actually. Maybe not yet. I don't
right.
know. See, my only problem with shows like that are they're like one season wonders, and then they go away, and they never get the chance to resolve what the...
Well, speaking of that, I don't know if you followed American Horror Story on FX, Wednesday Late Nights. That's a great flipping show. But they finished up a whole storyline last year, and I thought, well, it must have just been a one-season thing. Nope, they got a new season. They did something brilliant. They came up with a completely different story and completely different characters, but using the same cast. Brilliant.
Interesting. And even I've heard mixed reviews on that, so I'll have to check it out if you like it.
I love that show.
Okay. All right. Instead of sort of going through one, two believes list, has anything in particular like really stood out since we last talked to you about, you know, the world of sci-fi, TV, and movies?
The second we're not talking, 12 titles will pop into mind.
Exactly.
Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything in particular.
Right.
That's
right.
Why I was thinking if you throw some titles at me.
Yeah. How about Paul? I don't know if we talked about Paul.
We talked about Paul last time. I love that movie. I know after the last time I talked, someone made a comment about my questionable taste, and I laughed. I didn't know if they were referring to Paul or Green Lantern or what, because I liked both of them. And everybody hated Green Lantern. I think I'm like the only person in the world saying, hey, this is not a bad movie, guys. What's the problem here? There were things in Green Lantern I liked, and I thought Paul was just terrific. It was the perfect casting of Seth Rogen for perhaps the only time ever. And he'll probably never be cast that well again. Until Paul 2. They just had the perfect voice for exactly that character and the perfect personality for it. And that's where he fit really well. And it had a great cast. I thought it had a very engaging story. It was just a hell of a lot of fun. It was kind of warm and personal and funny.
Yeah, it's a good movie. I like that one a lot. All right. I guess that covers sort of the world of sci-fi in the last few years, so we can't cover all the list, because otherwise we'd be going a long time here.
I wish I could, and I know that there's other stuff that I would love to comment on, but it's not striking me off the top of my head.
Right. That's why we got to get you set up at BOA to start writing these reviews.
And by the way, just quick check on Netflix. The event is available. It's 5 discs and 22 episodes.
See, I find myself, I like the streaming version of Netflix much better, obviously, I presume you do too, but I'm almost too lazy to do the discs part.
I'm not set up for streaming is the problem. I don't have a PlayStation or anything like that. So it's just much easier for me to use the discs.
Yeah. Well, you can do it on the computer, but I don't know if, you say your computer's on its last legs anyway, so.
Right. And when I do things on my computer, I'm usually doing other things on my computer. I can't do something on my computer and watch something at the same time.
Ah, indeed.
So I'd have to kind of do it separately.
Yeah. All right. Next question comes from Vamp Elvis, who is a good friend of the program. He has a normal question and a funny one, and since he's a good friend of the show, I'll allow the funny one. The serious question is... he wonders if you've been contacted by recent BOA audio guest and doctoral candidate Robbie Graham, who's the man behind Silver Screen Saucers.
I don't even know the name.
Okay. Well, you should check out his stuff or listen to the episode he was on. He does. He essentially looks at the same idea of the government Hollywood portrayal of movies and what the government's role in all that might be.
Oh, yeah, I'd be very interested.
Yeah, so check out, he was on BOA Audio over the summer, so definitely one worth looking at.
What's his name again?
Robbie Graham.
I'll check him out.
Yeah, yeah. He's interesting, very deep thinker. I think he's on some interesting leads and stuff like that, so. And amazing
it's,
that he's doctoral.
It's a very deep field. There's a lot of stuff that can be mined out of it.
Indeed. And the funny question is, he says that you sound like a man who could rock an ascot or a smoking jacket with aplomb. So given the given the choice, which is your preference, smoking jacket or ascot?
It would definitely be the smoking jacket because the ascot screams Fred from Scooby-Doo.
Ah, yes. And as a Scooby-Doo buff, I guess you don't.
Well, Fred is lame. He's one of the lamest characters ever. That doesn't mean that I don't love him, but he is lame.
Did you enjoy the live-action Scooby-Doo movies? I liked the first one quite a bit.
Yes. I actually preferred the second one. I thought they were both good. In fact, they were showing one of those, was it tonight or last night? They had Scooby-Doo on just recently. I've seen it a couple times. I've got copies of both of them. I was able to get them cheap, you know.
I presume
like
so.
Huge hits.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get them in, like, packs.
I don't think I've seen the sequel. I'll have to check that one out.
I liked the sequel. I liked it better. It was closer to the actual original cartoon.
Is it the same cast?
Yeah, it's the same cast.
Oh, wow. I'm surprised I missed that, because I'm a huge fan of, like, these sort of cheesy-type movies, so.
Well, they did a great job with it. Like I said, there are very few incarnations of Scooby-Doo that I don't like. There are a couple that I don't like. When they're really juvenile, I don't care for those too much. Those just aren't much fun. Because there's so much you can do with Scooby-Doo. They're very simple stock characters. It's very simple stock situations. It's deliberately there to make fun of. And they frequently make fun of themselves and do it well.
Yeah. I don't remember. Were there allusions to Fred and Daphne having sex in the live-action movie or Velma being a lesbian?
I think there were some allusions to Velma being a lesbian.
Yeah, I think so, too, but I don't remember.
There were a couple of them at the bar. There was some girl who tried to pick her up at the bar.
Oh, Velma.
Everyone was just automatically assuming.
Exactly.
And in the second, she has an affair with Seth Green.
Oh, wow.
That's fun all by itself.
Yeah. They got all their friends in these movies.
Yep.
See, I like that sort of generation, I guess you could say, of actors. You know, they kind of fizzled out, obviously, but, you know.
Yeah, they all grew up together.
Yeah, the Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yeah, most of them, it's kind of hard finding any careers there. Sarah Michelle Gellar's still around, but, you know, I can't remember the last thing I saw her in.
She's probably coasting on residuals and shit now.
She's probably coasting on residuals, right.
And Freddie Prinze Jr. married her, so he's doing
right.
All right.
They're doing fine.
Seth Green's a producer. He makes Robot Chicken, so he's probably got the best
Very
career
funny show,
out
Robot
of all
Chicken.
Of them, yeah.
Robot Chicken is the second or third funniest show on Adult Swim. I think the Venture Brothers is the funniest.
I like that. I haven't seen Venture Brothers, so I'll check that out.
Oh, you've got to see Venture Brothers.
All right.
Did you like Johnny Quest? If you ever liked Johnny Quest when you were a kid, you will love the Venture Brothers because it's just a parody of Johnny Quest.
All right. I think I missed it, but I'd probably still enjoy it, so I'll check it out. Then the final submitted question comes from Hillbilly. And he says, thanks for this opportunity, Tim. He wants to know if you can offer insight into the career of Stanley Kubrick, which we've kind of already done.
Yes.
And he wants to know if you think Kubrick and other prolific directors have been given a glimpse behind the curtain of this fashioned reality we find ourselves in.
Yes. That was exactly what I was talking about earlier. I think Kubrick was probably deliberately bought by the government, basically, to fake the moon landings. That does not say whether or not we actually went to the moon, but what we saw on TV, I am convinced, was filmed in a studio, and it was probably Stanley Kubrick that did it.
Okay, fair enough. What about other prominent directors? Anyone you think? Spielberg?
Possibly.
That's the big one that everyone seems, he's like the next
generation. He would be top of my list, yeah.
Yeah.
If there is anyone that is currently looking behind the curtain, it would be Spielberg.
Interesting. What about George Lucas? A lot of people have sort of mixed feelings on him. I know he's a very rich man now, or I guess he's giving away the money that he made from the sale.
I tell you the truth, I don't think Lucas cares. I think he just, the only thing he cares about is inventing his fantasy land and tossing it out there and making billions of dollars on it.
Well, you know, he sold it to Disney.
Yep, $4 billion. $4 billion with a B.
Pretty amazing, just for something that he thought up, you know, and... Obviously the Joseph Campbell stuff and all that shit. That
right.
Sort of
well, I mean, after Campbell died, that's when he made the second three, and the second three were...
Yeah, exactly.
That's when he was just kind of stuck doing the comic book stuff, and the comic book stuff wasn't that good. I actually think Disney will make them better. I think the best thing that Lucas could have done was sell them to Disney.
Yeah.
They'll still hire him to use Industrial Light and Magic due to the effects, I'm sure.
I think it's overall a good move for the franchise, and I'm not even a big fan, but you got to get it out of his hands at some point, so it's good.
You got to get his fingers off the keyboard. He's got to stop writing scripts.
Right.
He can handle everything else. He's really going to stop writing scripts.
Now, as I said, that was the last of the submitted questions, and one that had come up between myself. I have a pop culture comedy show. Actually, you've met Jeremy Vaney. We had you on the Lost Cast back in the day, so you've spoken with Jeremy. He was really intrigued because we had been talking about your placement, I guess you could say, at the scene of the Aurora situation, and he was sort of wondering how he didn't. I don't have this to read off of, so I'm going to paraphrase, sure. I guess, or go by memory, and you know, hopefully, I do justice to his inquiry. But he was sort of wondering, as someone who's done extensive research into the field of conspiracy and cover up and all that stuff, whether you believe it or not, what do you think of just how this thing that you were at exploded into the conspiracy cover-up scene? Does it give you pause, I guess you could say, about the greater realm of conspiracy at large, if you will?
Yeah, actually. I'll tell you one thing that does bother me. First off, they got the right guy. I'm firmly convinced they got the right guy. However, I am constantly bothered by just how extensive this guy's knowledge was of explosives and booby traps. The FBI had never seen anything like that before. If the FBI hasn't seen it, who has?
Yeah.
That's really, really bothered me since. It's also bothered me wondering how he got into the theater, unless the door was propped, and I couldn't imagine the theater allowing the door to be propped. There are some questions that remain to be answered. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get them from the trial.
Yeah, I don't think so. Well, look at that guy that shot the congresswoman down there in Arizona. Like, they said he was too mentally impaired to do a trial, and they dragged it out, and then he pled guilty, you know, after he had, quote-unquote, treatment. And
right.
Then he just pled. There was no trial. So it's like, there's a very good chance that this guy, by the time the trial rolls around, they'll be like, he's too mentally incompetent to stand trial. Then 6 months, a year goes by, even less people are interested in the whole story, and then it's like, okay, he's okay now, and he realizes he's an asshole, and he pleads guilty.
I do have to wonder if the guy had some help, especially with the explosive stuff, and that does bother me. But I'm firmly convinced, A, that law enforcement knows all about it, if it is there, and B, we are never going to hear a word about it.
Interesting. What, you mean law enforcement knows that he had help, but they're not going to really do anything about it? Almost a Columbine-esque thing.
Yes. If he had help, I'm quite sure law enforcement knows about that and that they're going to keep it under wraps.
Why do you think they would do that?
Because they don't want to panic anybody. If he had help, it raises too many questions. Who would help someone with something like that?
Oh, okay. So you're saying that maybe the law enforcement knows that he had help, but they don't know who helped him, and they can't figure that out. So until they can actually bust down some dude's door and fucking bring him in, they're not going to go telling anybody.
Even then, they might not. There were other parties involved in Columbine. There was someone that got away. No one's ever found this guy. If you saw Bowling for Columbine, Roger Moore did raise an interesting point, which is that happened on the very day that we did the heaviest bombing in Kosovo.
Hello? Oh, I lost you. It's Michael Moore, by the way. Let me see if I can reconnect with you. For folks who are wondering, we were cut off in the middle of this conversation here about all this at 2:30 in the morning my time, and I lost my phone line for about an hour, and we had to set everything up to come back again tonight here, 21 and a half hours later, to
right.
wrap up the conversation. And where... The point you were making, to make this almost a seamless sort of transition between the 2 days' worth of conversation, I think you had made the point right as the line cut out that Columbine happened at the same time as some kind of when the U.S. was bombing, I want to say Kosovo or something like that. But my
That's right. It's in Bowling for Columbine. I didn't know it until I'd seen that movie. He mentioned that the shooting at Columbine took place on the same day that we did the most massive bombing in Kosovo. What makes that a curious coincidence is that the Columbine school happened to be kids of mostly defense contractors, you know?
Yeah.
We're a very heavy defense contracting state out here, and in fact, just a mile or two down the road from the theaters where the shooting took place is Buckley, Air Naval Guard Base. And there was, in fact, a guy from Buckley who was killed that night. That is coincidental, I'm certain. He just happened to be there because, of course, there are going to be some people from Buckley that go there. They live in this area. But the point is, there could be some kind of connection there. I don't necessarily look for one, but when I see something like, first off, noticing the Columbine problems, and that there was someone that wasn't caught at Columbine, or there were reports of someone who was never caught, you do kind of have to wonder in the back of your mind. I mean, certainly when all of us were out there and we saw mobile command units coming in and we've got bomb sniffing dogs, it crosses all of our minds immediately that there's a possibility of terrorism there.
Yeah.
And plainly you don't want to think that. But it is a possibility. There's a chance that this guy was not acting alone and that there was someone just using him. I'm sure they got the right guy, but there would be interested parties in maneuvering right guys like that. I'm hoping that's not the case. If it is the case, I'm certain that the appropriate authorities are fully aware of it and are doing everything they can to track that down. And I'm equally sure that we will never hear anything about that, if it is the case.
Now, that raises something that I thought of, actually, in the interim between the two over the last day. Earlier in the conversation, you made the point about aliens potentially using abductees to sabotage shit. Would this be a possible... And obviously you're not going out there and yelling this from the rooftop that this is what happened, but is this kind of a scenario that you, as an example, I guess you could say, you know what I mean?
There are certain factions in the government that would like their funding people to believe that. There's never been an abductee that was connected to any kind of crime like this.
Okay.
Never any murder, never any shooting, never anything like that. It wouldn't be in the press, however, or in any of the research, that they might have been involved in sabotage. I infer that they might have been involved in sabotage, and I'm reasonably certain there's very good reason to believe that that's possibly the case. It certainly explains a lot of why the government has handled things the way the government has handled things.
Yeah.
They would have to be concerned about that. Whether it was taking place or not, they would have to be concerned about it.
Now, what do you think of being from the area? What are your thoughts on the whole weirdness of Denver Airport, because a lot of conspiracy people like go crazy about that whole thing and how the rumors that that Denver's the alternate capital of the United States and it's the backup capital and all that stuff.
To the best of my knowledge, this is one place where I can meet them halfway. I consider most of the conspiracy theories about the IA to be just nuts. We certainly have some hideous artwork out there, and God knows how the hell it ever got put up. Whether there's anything that can be read into it or not, I don't know. I can't look at it long enough to tell you. It's really hideous. I don't go there very often. I mean, it looks like 8-year-olds finger-painted this crap up there, and how they ever got that approved, I don't know. It's just awful.
Yeah.
And some really ridiculous shit. However, the idea of Denver being the alternate capital, I believe Denver actually is the alternate or secondary capital. I don't remember when that was decided, and I'd have to chase that down. But I believe that it actually is, we are historically the second capital. If anything happened to Washington, D.C., they'd move here. I could be wrong on that, but I have heard that several times before, and I'd need to chase it down to verify it.
Yeah.
I don't think that's really a conspiracy theory. I think there's something to that.
Right, right. Stands to reason. That's where NORAD is, and they probably have more sort of secure,
right,
you know, carved out mountains and shit out there. So.
Right. Well, we're also away from the coasts and, you know, kind of centrally located in the middle of the country.
Right.
So, it does make sense in a number of ways. I'm not even sure where exactly I'd research that. I could probably just type it into the search engine and find the answer pretty quick. But, yeah, I don't consider that necessarily a conspiracy theory. That does make sense to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the only other question here was one I could have sworn that someone posted. Maybe they posted it and then edited it and took it out and changed it to one of the questions we already read. But in the time I was looking over the questions before I sat down to write them, well, I didn't write them, I copied them all for the interview, I could have sworn someone asked about getting your books on Kindle. And I think we've talked about this before. What's the possibility, because the books are hard to get now. So, and I know we've talked about
this. The second one is, anyway, the first is, this is what I got a few months ago. I haven't really chased this down yet. The second's been out of print for a little while. I'm not sure exactly when that happened. The first is not out of print. It's just currently out of stock, which means they're getting around to reprinting it or coming up with a new edition or just putting more copies out or something. So that one might be temporarily a little difficult to get a hold of. The second one, it goes for premium prices on Amazon. I kind of laugh at that. You know, it didn't sell that well, apparently, but now that it's out of print, people can actually command some money for it. And in some cases, they ask just ridiculous prices. But you can still actually get used copies at a reasonable price of the second. Anyway, I was interrupting, and I'm not sure exactly what the question was again.
Well, the other part was
Kindle.
Yeah, well, I'm seeing here now, $146 someone's charging for it.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. I mean, I've seen it go as high as $500-something, and I just laugh. So you've got to be flipping kidding me. I mean, even if the thing's out of print, no one is going to pay that kind of money. You can always find a used copy for, you know, $15, $20 somewhere. I see them on Amazon. I don't check very often. The last time I checked is when I was prompted to contact the publisher and see what had happened, because I figured it had to be out of print when I was seeing ridiculous prices being charged for it.
Yeah.
And they confirmed that, but like I said, the first one is apparently, they call it one of their best sellers. Don't ask me. I mean, my bank account doesn't know the difference. But it's still in print. It's just currently out of stock. And since I talked to them, they've probably printed up some more copies.
Now, do you...
The Kindle thing...
Yeah, the Kindle part,
I keep forgetting this. You'd have to ask the publisher about that. I have no idea.
Yeah.
They're the ones that handle all that stuff. They might put it up for Kindle. I suppose if you contacted them and asked them, you could find out. It's still Frog Books, but they're owned by Random House now in New York.
Yeah.
So that always makes it kind of fun if someone says, who's your publisher? I have to say Random House, but I would say actually it's Frog, but... You know, got bought by Random House. So technically, yeah, I'm covered by Random House now.
Interesting. I don't know how the book world works. Like, how long do they have the rights to it until, like, could you, do you, I don't even, it's technical, but not super technical to get it into Kindle format. Like, I presume, though, that you don't have the rights to do that. But could you actually eventually do that, you think? Or would you have to painstakingly
recycle?
Yes,
I could eventually do that. I really have to find out. I've got to dig up my contract, and I could get them to send me a copy of it, actually. I know it's here. I just have to find it.
Yeah.
That would give me the technical stuff I need to know. I believe when a book goes out of print, I seem to recall this in the contract, there's a certain period of time where if it remains out of print and they don't do anything with it, you get the rights automatically returned to you. There might be some kind of a fee for delivering the materials, but all the materials are supposed to return to the author. And then you can just, I could go to resell it.
Yeah.
You know? Then what I do is just go for a paperback, a regular mass market paperback thing.
Yeah.
And it's possible someone would pick it up. Questionable, but possible. And even if something doesn't sell all that well in its initial printing, doesn't mean that it wouldn't do well on a mass paperback.
I think it would do extremely well in Kindle, too, because that seems
probably
to be the new way of the world with these books and stuff. And, you know, if you could get the rights back, you'd be all right, because it's really just a matter of...
Oh, well, certainly, yeah, the Kindle would be negotiated, and I'm sure if it went in a reprint, the Kindle would be available in Kindle. Everything is anymore.
Yeah. You should definitely try that out, because I think people are dying for this, for the book in a way, you know? They really want to be able to get their hands on it, so.
Now.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, before we couldn't sell it. Now everybody wants it. Hey, I want this book.
anything else we need to talk about? Anything else? Well, it's so weird here because it's like a whole day later, so so it feels like we just started talking, but we've got almost 2.5 hours in the can already. So, is there anything else? Which I guess we already kind of talked about the potential for this Pirates book. So that's something that you don't want to overly tease, but may happen someday.
It may happen someday. The entire reason that I don't do stuff like that. I don't really think about writing books anymore because there's just no money in it.
Yeah.
Even if you get a legitimate publisher and go through the process and all of that, yes, it'll get you in some libraries, and yes, it will get enough attention that you might end up, I might end up making friends like you and getting onto this kind of show. I do have some readers who are, let's just say they've got credentials. And yes, they do pay serious attention to me, and once in a blue moon, I actually have a conversation with one of them. So I know I'm read in some pretty interesting circles, and I'm considered legit. I mean, if anyone wants to argue that I'm, you know, mad or anything like that for believing in Martians, that's fine. But nobody quibbles with my research. The research is fine. It's all done properly, and no one quarrels with that.
Yeah.
So that alone does get some attention in the right places. But there's just no money in it. If you have the leisure time... H.P. Lovecraft once said that writing is something that only leisured gentlemen can do because there's no money in it. He's absolutely right. You have to do it just because you love it and because you happen to have the time and you're not pressed to do anything else. When I wrote my books, that was the case. Now, I'm relatively kind of in that position now, but I am going to have to worry about income sometime in the foreseeable future. And that just puts a damper on the idea of writing anything.
It
takes way too much time and way too much effort.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of where I'm at. I don't have time to sit down and write a book.
Yeah.
You know, everybody else I know has got books out and shit, but it's like, I don't have time.
It's going to take a very long period of time. It's going to take you a year. And getting the research and getting everything written down and polishing up and all that kind of nonsense, let alone finding a publisher for it, you're going to be at least a year at that, I promise you.
Yeah.
And, you know, the chance that you're going to get published is even questionable. It would be a little bit easier for me because I do have a couple books under my belt. That always helps.
Yeah. So we talked about the Kindle thing. And we talked about Vaney's question. We did all the listener questions. I think that's it. I think we got everything covered.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So, on that note, I guess we bid farewell. That was the other thing I was gonna say. I gotta get my webmaster on this thing to get the blog format set up at Banal of America, so we can bring you in to write and get some of this stuff out for more people. You know.
Oh yeah, that'd be great.
Because I would definitely love to have you as part of the team here of writers. So, and I know you have a lot to say.
And it's an awful lot of fun to talk about.
Exactly. And I guess, you know, on that note, we bid farewell here for the year. It's been an amazing conversation, Bruce. It really, I enjoyed it quite a bit. And we went down so many different avenues. And really, you know, that's thanks to you and thanks to the listeners who submitted all these questions. So, you know.
I would like to take a moment to thank the all of the listeners for the questions that they sent. I think they were intelligent questions. They were very well thought out. And it was a pleasure thinking about them. Some of them were really excellent.
They really were, and as I've marveled over the course of the conversation, went down a whole bunch of different avenues that, you know, may not have dawned on me to ask you about for a year or two or ever, you know, like I said, with this, especially with the moon hoax thing. I think about it from time to time, and I'm like, I gotta ask Bruce about that again. Then, you know, time goes by, and we sit down and talk, and it just completely goes out of my brain. So, yeah, they really came up with some great stuff. So, you know, it's... In keeping, I guess, sort of with this overall theme, you know, we call it Rucksgiving, but it ties into Thanksgiving, and it's, you know, give thanks to you for coming on the show and being, you know, really giving with your time and being a big part of this program. And, you know, I know you don't do a lot of shows. You don't do any shows. You only do Banal of America, it seems. And
yeah, you're pretty much exclusive.
Yeah, I really appreciate that.
I'd probably do another show if anyone asked, depending on what it was. But, I mean, there's some places I don't think I'd want to show up. But... Yeah, I definitely enjoy being on your show.
Well, I really enjoy talking to you, and you know, people enjoy the program because it sounds like a conversation between two old friends, and I can honestly say that it really, when it's a conversation between you and me, it is a conversation between two now old friends, because we've known each other for quite a while at this point. And
This is coffee conversation for me. I do this kind of conversation all the time with my friends, and you're one of them. So
exactly. And the listeners are, they're kind of like those guys, the men in black sitting at the table listening in, so...
Yeah. Only they're welcome.
Exactly. Yeah, they're welcome to come over and sit down and grab a cup of coffee and join in on the conversation. So
sure.
Thank you once again, Bruce, and I hope you have a fantastic Thanksgiving. And obviously, I'll be in touch over the course of the year, leading up to next year's Thanksgiving. And you know, the listeners, I'm sure, really appreciate it. And again, big thanks to them for their submissions. And once again, big thanks to you. I hope you have an awesome Thanksgiving holiday. And you know, I can't thank you enough for doing this and really embracing being a part of our new holiday tradition.
Thank you very much. The feeling is mutual.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7 and the 2012 installment of Rucksgiving. Big, big thanks, of course, to the amazing Bruce Rucks for returning for the new BOA Audio holiday tradition. If you would like to hear more from Bruce Rucks, check out our landmark trilogy of episodes back in Season 4, around 6 hours of conversation with Bruce Rucks, and of course, dig up last year's Rucksgiving for additional in-depth discussion. And hopefully it will not be another year before you hear from Bruce Rucks. I am going to seriously get down to business on bringing him aboard BOA for some written offerings for the BOA readers. Stay tuned. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA audio listener feedback, and we've got 3 selections from the BOA listeners, so let's just dive on in. First one comes from Carl, posting on the BOA Facebook page. He says, "Hey Tim, the recent film Ancient Aliens Debunked is ruffling a lot of feathers in the UFO world. I've seen the whole movie and it is thoroughly researched, documented, compelling, and convincing. How about a head-to-head or civil panel discussion with Chris White
and some ufologists or something. I might suggest Bruce Maccabee on the UFO side, since he is a physicist and can talk real science. Great guy, too. Carl, posting on the BOA Facebook page. Thank you for writing in, Carl. Thank you for the tip on this film, Ancient Aliens Debunked. I have not heard about it. I presume Chris White is the man behind the film. I will definitely check that out, and if it's as compelling as you say, I will definitely follow up on it for a future edition of BOA Audio. Regarding the whole head-to-head concept or civil panel discussion, that's definitely something I would be down for and something I've considered here at the end of the program and asked for suggestions. So this may be an avenue to finally get down to business on the whole debate theme episode that I've sort of tinkered with or contemplated over the last few years. So you may have lit a long fuse here, Carl, on a very exciting addition to the program in the future. But nonetheless, I will definitely look at Ancient Aliens Debunked and see what it's all about. Our next correspondence comes from Wayne. No hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. In your recent BOA episode featuring Nick Redfern, during the feedback section, you mentioned that it doesn't seem like paranormal events happen to people in governments or positions of power. This account from Simon Parks, a counselor from Whitby, Northshire, UK, comes to mind. And then he follows that up with a YouTube link detailing the story here of Simon Parks. So thank you for writing in, Wayne. I'll suggest folks, I guess, Google Simon Parks, and you spell Parks, P-A-R-K-E-S, to find out more about this case. Very, very interesting, Wayne. Thank you for sending that along. It's always great when the BOA Audio listeners hear the feedback portion of the show and have some insights and additional information for me to fill out the virtual conversation I'm having here with the listeners at the end of the show. So thank you, Wayne, for sending that along. I should also mention Wayne's posting here reminded me that there's also that controversial abduction case that Bud Hopkins talked about involving someone from the UN. That's probably the only other story I can think of with people in positions of power or government experiencing some kind of paranormal event. And finally here on listener feedback, we've got a very nice email from Marco. No hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. I wanted to make a brief comment concerning your show in general. I've been a listener since almost the very beginning. I've listened to many paranormal type podcasts and internet radio shows. Yours is by far the best. When I listen to your show, I don't feel as if I'm listening to an interview. It's more like eavesdropping on a conversation between close friends. Instead of an interviewer, you are more of a master of ceremonies, giving your guests the spotlight. You don't interrupt and give each guest, most of whom are icons in their respective fields, the respect they deserve. So many people, rightly or wrongly, believe that they have experienced something esoteric, and it is so, so important that they have a place to turn to where they can be comforted by the fact that they are not alone in their experiences. Keep up the great work for many years to come. Respectfully, Marco. Wow, Marco, thank you so much for the very kind email. I included this one, I'll admit it, folks. I just put it at the end because it was such a nice email and really kind of lifted my spirits here on a late evening as I put together the Rux Giving edition of the program. Sometimes you get these emails and they just give you the final boost to get over the edge and wrap up another edition of the program. Thank you so much, Marco. I really appreciate your kind words, sir. And the key word in that whole email, I think, is conversation. That's the real goal of the program at the end of the day. These are not interviews. These are conversations with some of the very best and brightest researchers of the unknown. That is the BOA way. And thank you so much, Marco, for not just recognizing that, but heaping praise on me. Man, I really am humbled beyond words. So on that note, we will wrap up listener feedback this week. Thank you to Marco for writing in. Thank you to Wayne and Carl also for posting on Facebook with their feedback. If you would like to participate in future installments of BOA Audio listener feedback, there are a myriad of ways to do so. You can head on over to Banal of America and click the contact button. Or you can write to BOAAudio@hotmail.com. And you can also join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. Additionally, you can find me on Facebook or Twitter. Just punch in Binall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, and that'll bring up my profiles on those respective sites. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And finally, for those folks keeping score at home, the BOA Facebook page now, I believe, has 836 people, so we're climbing closer and closer to the mythical, possibly unreachable, 1,000 likes. And as you may have noticed here on BOA Audio Listener Feedback, the BOA Facebook page is an awesome place to fast-track your listener feedback. I always cull there for new postings from folks to read here at the end of the program. So if you want to really ensure a place on BOA Audio Listener Feedback, like us on Facebook and post at the BOA page, and chances are you'll be hearing your musings at the end of the program in the not-too-distant future. Now, of course, it is time for me to thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. I know it has been a crazy time at BOA with wild posting dates, not just for the audio series, but also for the columnist pieces. And on that note, I just want to give a sincere thanks to the amazing BOA staff, not just folks who write for the website, but folks who are really and truly great friends and longtime hardcore supporters of the program. The BOA staff are the very best. They are ride or die folks, and I really and truly appreciate that. Hope they all have a fantastic Thanksgiving holiday. Speaking of which, what a perfect segue into the donations portion of the program. I cannot give enough thanks to all the folks out there, especially the hardcore BOA audio listeners, the ones who stick around to the very end of the show. And if you'd like to express some thanks via donations, there are a pair of ways to do so. You can head on over to binallofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the PayPal button. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. But what if you don't trust the internet? What if you want to make a donation via snail mail? Well, you're in luck because we have a P.O. box for that very reason. Just send it off to Tim Binall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866, and you can find the complete address at Binall of America under the PayPal button. As we always say at the end of the donation plug, folks, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Binall of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of the program, we are once again bringing back some long-time friends of the show. The incomparable Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman return for another fast-paced and very loose conversation, this time around looking at time travel. For the folks who have heard Marie and Larry on the program in previous seasons, you know that these conversations run the gamut and really just go all over the place, but they're always grounded in some tremendous research and also some really unique investigations into arcane aspects of the esoteric. In the past, we've looked at numbers and 1111, we've looked at the Trinity and the number 3, as well as deja vu. So this time around, looking at time travel is once again another very enlightening and thought-provoking conversation, but also containing a lot of laughs because it always breaks down into a bit of a riot when I'm talking to Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman. That's next time on BOA Audio. And on that note, we close the book on Ruxgiving 2012. Once again, big, big thanks to the amazing Bruce Rux. Thanks again to Carl, Wayne, and Marco for their contributions to BOA audio listener feedback, and, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the BOA audio listeners, the folks who contributed questions for Ruxgiving 2012, the folks who are listening to this right now riding to Grandma's house, or have settled down after a delicious Thanksgiving meal and are tuning in to Ruxgiving 2012, or the people who are avoiding the sales and are just hanging around on Black Friday listening to Banal of America. It is bizarre to think that this little program is a part of a lot of people's holiday traditions and a part of their big annual weekend here. So I really do appreciate it, and I'm just humbled and thrilled to be a part of so many people's lives and reaching so many folks out there. And I hope you all have a fantastic Thanksgiving holiday. And once again, thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.